Welcome to the Changing Scripts podcast, where we describe our personal language learning stories with the focus right now on Mandarin Chinese. My name is Stephanie, and I was a language instructor for about 15 years, mostly in Asia. I have been learning Mandarin Chinese for about a year now. This podcast is part of the Changing Scripts PodTube experience. The podcast part is where I chat with other language learners and native speakers in Mandarin Chinese about their language learning experience. And the YouTube channel is where I share my own personal successes, failures, and questions while I slowly but steadily learn to read Mandarin Chinese.
In this podcast, we're talking to Taylor, who is an American who comes from a traditional monolingual home, but had an interest in learning languages very early on. One of the languages that she picked up and has kept up with is Mandarin Chinese. Her relationship with Mandarin Chinese is similar to what Tanya said in the last episode, where it feels like a person. In fact, Taylor talks about languages as children and how many children or how many family members can you have while paying attention to all of them. Taylor is one of the first people that I met in the language learning community on social media, specifically on Twitter, and I'm very excited to have you meet her. Also, don't forget that since this is a PodTube, there is a YouTube channel that accompanies this very podcast episode. In this particular episode out today, I do expand a little bit more on Taylor's idea of language as a family. This is in reading goals and her penchant for wanting to learn more about classical Chinese. But let's get to Taylor because her story is so interesting.
Thank you so much, Taylor, for joining us on Changing Scripts today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me over.
Taylor, how would you summarize your language learning story?
I've been learning languages for over 10 years now, and I'm currently learning Mandarin Chinese and Persian. And for 2019, I'm planning to add in a third language, but I haven't decided what that is yet.
Do you have it narrowed down at all to a few contenders?
Like between 6 or 7.
Okay, let me
think. I always forget one of them. I feel so bad. Okay, so I'm learning Chinese and Persian, but I'm debating between making a third one either Hindi, Vietnamese, Arabic, Swahili, Indonesian, Tamil, or I told you I forget the last one, but there's one more that I was thinking about. But yes.
Oh my gosh, that's hard to pick.
It is. It's very different reasons for each one, too.
Like for Vietnamese, Mandarin would give you a little bit of a cheat or a head start, but not script-wise, of course, but there's some language stuff in common. But Arabic has always been on my back burner, script-wise and sound-wise. I think it sounds really beautiful. I don't know.
It's a toughie. Yeah. So for Vietnamese, I just want to learn it because a good friend of mine is Vietnamese and has a limited English proficiency. So that's more just like personal. I was thinking it'd be useful for like business purposes at some point in the future, but it's only spoken in Vietnam. And with China's domination in the area, like I think just Mandarin would be useful pretty much throughout South Asia.
Well, there is a huge Vietnamese diaspora. And also, if you have a personal reason and someone to use it with, that's kind of a big pull, though.
This is a tough decision.
It is a tough decision. I'm glad I'm not the one making it.
My third language, I wanted it to be one that was 50% a language I thought was interesting in its own right, and then one that would also be useful for the future, you know, for job-seeking purposes or economic purposes, because I also don't have kids right now, but in the future, I'd like my kids to be multilingual. So I'd want to pass on a language that would be useful when they're coming of age, too, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, sure.
Again, Indonesia is an emerging economy, but then I'm like, it's only really useful in Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia. Hindi,
well,
I wanted.
Well, Indonesia is a very populous place, though. Just
it is
of itself. Yeah,
it is. So, I mean, this is why I have difficulty. I'm like, there's good points and, you know, drawbacks. So I've tried Hindi and Arabic multiple times throughout my life, and it's always been a mega fail. I feel I should in theory just click with them, but something about it just doesn't click with me. And I'm sure that's also the quality of the resources are nowhere near what you could get for like Spanish or French.
Sure.
Like you have to wonder, like, whoever thought this was a good textbook idea with some of this.
Oh, I've had that for so many languages. Yeah, I know. Although they're getting better for Arabic with the internet and stuff, there's a lot more material coming from individuals than from big
language textbook mm-hmm. producers. Mm-hmm. Nice, because then you can get the dialect you're looking for in the country you're looking for, not just the standard that barely anybody, if anybody, uses.
Yeah, so there's that.
But anyway, we got to back up to your origins, your linguistic origins, Taylor.
Okay. So
I ask everybody this, what was your first language or language?
Raised in a monolingual English-speaking household.
Okay, so no other languages around you in the home. How about around you in the community? Were there any?
No, English speaking. Yeah, all English speaking.
So how did you get into languages then?
Oh, long story here. So I learned Spanish throughout, you know, elementary school and middle school. Couldn't speak of like a Spanish because as I remember it, we were just learning the same material every year.
Okay.
And I don't remember any of my teachers. No offense to them. They were, you know, good people. But I don't remember any of my teachers in elementary or middle school having had a certification to teach Spanish. So they were kind of just tossed into it or like, oh, you took Spanish in college. You can teach these kids. And we never got anywhere because how much are you going to teach like eight-year-olds? When I was a little kid, I didn't really have an interest in languages because I never thought of language learning as a thing. It's like a monolingual American household.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was a little kid, my dad would bring me National Geographics. I was in love with National Geographics. So I think that is what spurred my interest in Asia and the Middle East as a little kid. And then as my mother will tell you, when I was like 3 years old, we were watching The King and I together, the 1950s one. With Yul Brynner.
Mm-hmm.
And she turned it off for some reason. And then I went into my little playroom where I had a TV because I was a 90s kid. And, you know, luxurious living as a 90s kid. And I put it on there and watched it by myself. And, you know, in retrospect, it was probably just the costuming and the sets, which were very elaborate and very, very different from what I saw in my 1990s household mm-hmm. in the Northeastern United States. So that's what spurred my interest in Asia. I started getting interested in languages, though, in my freshman year of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a very good story. It's just kind of a bleh story. But I took French instead of Spanish because I was like, I've studied Spanish all throughout middle school. This is boring. I want to learn French. And my French teacher was very encouraging, very sweet lady. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first quarter, she was giving back our tests and she said, oh, she wrote on the paper, congratulations, mademoiselle, you have a 99% in my class. That's the highest in this class. And it made me feel so good.
Aww.
And it was, yeah. And so in the beginning, I think the language learning was just, I wanted that positive reinforcement, but mm-hmm. then I started really getting into languages. So I took French and Spanish at my high school. I took Italian classes on the side. And then I fiddled around a lot with Russian as a high school student. I know that was a lot of information.
Wow.
That's broadly my origin story. Yeah, that's a lot right there.
Wow, wow, wow. Okay, so far I have French, Spanish, English, Italian, and Russian. And yes. That's all just by the end of high school.
Yes.
Do you still use or do you feel like you could use a lot of those now?
My Russian, no, because I only fiddled around with it a little bit. Italian... I didn't learn that much. Spanish, I mean, I've forgotten most of it, but I still feel like when I watch, like in Breaking Bad, and they'll have someone speaking Spanish, or Narcos when they have Spanish, I'll get a lot of it because they're the cognates, you know, or the sentence structure isn't that drastically different.
Yeah.
So I'll get the idea sometimes.
Now, I don't know Narcos, but I have heard that name. That is like a reality drug busting TV show kind of thing?
No. So. My boyfriend watched more of it. I came in like midway through, but it's at least the first two seasons focused on Pablo Escobar,
mm-hmm.
The famous drug lord.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, and then the newer season is focusing on a different drug cartel. But it's supposed to be sort of, I guess, historical, semi-historical.
Okay. I misread that wrong. I saw it just briefly like in social media a few times. Like I'd see people talking about it, but I didn't realize it was historical. Okay. Well, before we get too far past high school, let's back up a bit and talk more about that first language or languages. People seem to fall on one side or the other as a kid. They either like reading and writing or they like speaking and listening, that kind of thing. Where did you fall?
Oh, I was a reading and writing kid. I was very, very bashful growing up. So speaking to me was just not something I enjoyed whatsoever. I was a big reader. And I didn't do too much writing, but at the same time, I also had a super vivid imagination and loved putting together stories. I just never wrote them down. So I was a reading and writing kid for sure.
Nice. Do you remember your first library experience?
My first library experience? No, I don't. I remember going to libraries as a kid,
yeah,
but it actually wasn't all that often. As a kid, I was a book snob, so I would make my parents buy me all of my books. I thought that renting books from the library was beneath me. And now, ironically, when I go to the library, I get like 30 books at a time. Like, when I go to the library now, I don't even have to say anything. They're like, oh, it's Taylor. And they pull out my mountain of books.
Oh my gosh. Wait. Okay, let's backtrack a second. You were an avid reader and your parents bought all your books for you. How many bookshelves did you have?
Oh dear, I don't even know.
I don't know. Because I was a reader and a library kid, and I would go and get like the maximum amount of books and come back like in a week. And if I had kept all of those, oh my goodness, like the whole room would be filled, if not more.
Well, I guess two reasons why I wasn't a library kid. There wasn't a library that close to my house. It was like a 15-minute drive.
Yeah.
So it wasn't close enough where it would be like, let's go to the library.
That's close by East Coast standards.
Well, whatever. But my school library too, we had a library, but I went to like a Catholic school and there was never that culture of let's let the children roam freely in the hallway. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, it's your free period. Go to the library. Yeah. So like it was never a thing. Like, I have free time. Let me go to the library and get some books.
Yeah, I did not go to a school like that. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And as I remember it, now given this is like 20 years ago, as I remember it though, the library wasn't that great because it was like a small, I don't believe that. I believe they were a pretty poor small elementary school. So the quality of books wasn't that great either.
Oh yeah. No, we used to play hide and seek in our library at school. It wasn't like a super wealthy area. I don't honestly know why the libraries were so nice. Were so big. And to be fair, a lot of the books were super duper boring. Like the fiction section was nice for a kid, but a lot of the other sections had like super old, almost moldy kind of stuff that nobody really ever went to, but they had a lot of them. So we would run around, much to the chagrin of the librarian. We would run around a lot.
See, our library was just one room, like one old classroom that was converted. It was, gotcha.
Yeah.
No offense to my old elementary school, in case anybody from there is listening.
Yeah, no. Schools, teachers, communities, educational systems, there's a lot of factors going into the decisions that are made, and we're incredibly forgiving because people do what they can with what they have.
Yes.
That's my disclaimer. Okay, so we've already touched on the languages you learned in elementary school and high school, the National Geographic thing, which, by the way, yay, good choice. Oh, were there any other magazines as a kid that you read a lot of?
No, I didn't. The National Geographics were actually kind of a fluke. I think my father got them from a coworker or a neighbor who got them. And because he liked them too as a kid because the pictures were just so awesome. Mm-hmm. So that's how, I mean, they sort of came into our home just by accident. My parents actually aren't big readers. My mother likes to read, but she doesn't have the time. Mm-hmm. And my father doesn't read at all. I make fun of him for it, but I wouldn't... Because he'll be like, I read so much last night, Taylor. I'm like, how much did you read, Dad? He's like, I finished a chapter. It was 10 pages. He's just a slow reader. And like, I know some people are like that, no offense. Whereas you have my mother, I would get mad at her because I would join these little book groups in elementary school. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what they were called, but like you would read the books in the fall and winter, and then the spring you would go to like a competition where you would do trivia and writing contests about them. And I forget what they were called. I forget what they were called. But like it would be four or five books and I would read them. And I was a kid, so I read a little slower. And then my mean old mother would finish them in like 2 hours. And it would tick me off to no end.
Wow. Okay. I've never heard of those. So were there teams or was it an individual competition?
No, it was like you as your school would go as a team.
Oh, okay.
Shoot, I don't remember what they were called. I'll have to ask my mother.
Like, I'm looking at book reading competition, but all I'm seeing is the British Council, ironically.
No.
Facebook book reading competition. Yeah, they probably have a special name. Interesting.
They, Yeah, and every year they would also, you get to meet one of the authors from the books.
Ooh.
Which was cool. It was cool.
That's really cool. Yeah, no, I would have been game for that. I don't know that I would have been game for the competition because I am a slow reader and it would have taken me like years to get through most of those books. But meeting the authors, I've always been a huge fan of, like, at least being in the room with them.
Well, the thing is too, I feel like these books, they were good books for children overall, but like the questions they would ask you were, I don't think, things that they were like above what a middle schooler would like read into it. You know, they were like adult analysis level questions. Like I remember there was this one book called Stealing Freedom and it's in the United States when slave owning was still legal. And it's about, you know, abolitionists and that they're trying to Stealing Freedom.
Gotcha. Okay.
I believe the author is named Eliza Carbone or Carbone, but it was about, you know, they're trying to get these slaves to Canada so they can be free people. But one of the things was the slave owner, as happened back then, slept with one of his slaves and they had a child and the child was African American, but he had blue eyes. Mm-hmm. And I remember to this day, one of the questions was, why do you think this little boy character has blue eyes? And it went over her head. We're like, I don't know, genetics. And now as I'm an adult, I get it. Like, oh, because the slave owner slept with his slave.
Yeah.
The child was half black, half white. Now I get it. But I'm like, at 10, you're not going to get that.
No.
You know?
No, not at all. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So they didn't tailor the questions necessarily to that.
Not necessarily. I just read it because they were good books. They were fun books as a kid.
Okay. So then we're going to go back into your language learning. So we stopped at high school. So where did Chinese come in then?
So this also involves some backstory. So throughout high school, I had been interested in Russian. Part of it was just the region. Like it was very, again, very different, very, you know, like a mix of European and Asian influences. And it was really appealing to me. Also, side note, I had a crush on a Russian hockey player. And I had this illogical high school girl fantasy that if I learned Russian, I could be his Russian translator and we would fall in love happily ever after.
That sounds totally logical to me. I don't know what you're talking about.
And I also wanted to work for the UN. Mm-hmm. So in high school, I thought I'm going to learn Russian and then get this cool career as a translator in some political context. I took Russian my first semester, didn't really care for it that much. And my Russian teacher made a remark to me, which just killed my confidence. And I said, forget it. I'm not learning Russian anymore. So the next year, I knew I wanted to learn a language. But I didn't know what. And my dad was like, you need to learn Chinese because this was 2010, 2011. And China was, you know, pumping along economically at the time. So I was like, well, all right, it's different. I'll learn it. And I ended up really enjoying it. So it kind of just happened serendipitously. It wasn't that great of a story. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, as a kid, I was much more interested in Japan as an Asian culture as opposed to China.
Sure.
So that's how I got into Chinese, yes.
Okay. How many years did you take official classes versus how many years did you self-study?
So I took Chinese for 3.5 years in college.
Wow.
And I've been self-studying for the 3 years since then. So altogether, Chinese has been in my life for a little over 6 years.
I love how you say that like it's a person because it feels like a breathing entity to me sometimes.
This sounds strange, but I do think of Chinese as like a friend or like a family member because it's such an integral part of my life and my interests.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of going back to the adding in a third language thing, I do have a good friend who is a prolific language learner. She's very inspiring. Mm-hmm. But a while ago, I told her like, I want to learn Turkish and I want to learn Hindi and I want to learn 10 other languages. And she was like, that's all well and good. But you also have to remember that there's only a certain level of fluency you're going to reach if you learn all of those.
Yep.
And she found it helpful to think of the languages as like children and how many children can you manage at one time? And she said, I top out at 3. I can only handle 3 children. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's kind of a good point. So that's sort of why I'm planning on adding in the third, and that's probably going to be it for at least long-term hardcore language learning.
Yeah. I've heard this a lot recently from polyglots. Mm-hmm. Like people will say, oh, I can speak 11 or 20 languages or whatever. But when you really, really dive into it, as far as like having some sort of depth of the language, they would definitely prioritize them into like the ones they really, really can use to talk about anything, yes. and ones that they can kind of just do kind of somewhat functional things and those kinds of things. So yeah, 3 sounds like a good family size.
Yes. And that, no offense to the language learning community, I followed them for a long time, but that's sort of a problem I have with the community where they're like, I speak 8 languages and that's good. But if you can only have conversational proficiency in them on topics that you're comfortable discussing, I don't consider you fluent in that language. To me, to be fluent, you have to be able to read, write, listen, and speak to at least like a, let's say like a 10th grade level. And that's a very high bar for a lot of people. But to me, it feels disingenuous to say you're fluent when you can only speak it for conversational purposes. Myself. No offense to anyone else.
I get that. I have a slightly different qualm. Mine is about speed and people putting out stuff into the world on how fast they get good at a language.
Yes.
I feel like I want to be, I can't be yet. I need another couple of years, ironically, but I want to be like the willing sacrificial lamb for the slow language movement. Because I feel like people focus so much on how quickly they can be functional or even what they would call fluent in language, whether they are or not. And I feel like that's a disservice to most people who struggle at learning a language. And I think that's a lot of why, especially Americans, really we don't have a lot of opportunity to practice a lot of the times, or we have really crappy instruction and materials and whatnot. And it just, we can't just go to the neighboring country and practice all the time. You know?
No.
We've only got one of those right there. And the other one's generally English speaking, although granted there's some French, but I mean, it's just not as easy as in some other places. And so the speed thing is the thing that really gets me.
It does make me cringe when I see those things like use our app for 10 minutes a day and you'll be speaking fluently in a month. It just makes me want to like poke out my eyeballs and scream into the void.
And I have no doubt that there are people that are insanely talented and that they've got a natural cognitive ability in that area and they can probably do it. But the vast majority of people, just like Olympic athletes, the vast majority of people cannot be an Olympic athlete.
No,
the vast majority of people cannot learn languages that fast.
Exactly.
Yeah. So there's a lot of flaws in the community, but there's also a lot of interesting stuff that comes out of the polyglot and language learning community too. And it's a matter of sifting through it. And that takes time. And again, people want to do things quickly. Meh.
In regards to your point about slow language learning, there is this one language learner. I found her over the summer, but she's been on YouTube for a while.
Yeah.
Her YouTube channel is called Kemushi-chan.
How do you spell that?
K-E-M-U-S-H-I. C-H-A-N. But her English name is Loretta. And
I watch her.
Isn't she so inspiring?
I love her. I'm sorry, I didn't know her Japanese name. But yeah, I totally and completely watch her. Sometimes the videos that are completely in Japanese, I get a little subtitled out, but I do watch her and I think she's amazing.
She's had these two videos recently where she, and I am like, I am so inspired by her doing this because it takes a lot of guts. But she's pulled out videos of herself speaking Japanese from like 10 years ago.
I saw that. Yeah.
And to me, I'm like, you sound good. I don't speak Japanese, but I think you sound good.
Right. And she also like, did a video a few months ago where she was talking about the struggles she has with like, because she's at university in Japan. And so she was talking about like, how long it takes her to do things. And, you know, even though she can do X, Y, and Z, and she's learned the language at this level, she still has to look things up and all these kinds of things. And I'm like, thank you for saying the real things, the things that are like the challenges, not just how fluent you are.
I feel like learning Japanese too, she should get some extra credit because that they've got multiple scripts going on.
Yeah.
I feel like Japanese is just a big old ball of nonsense. It's a pretty language. It's a cool language, but like grammatically, tons of nonsense going on there.
Oh my God. Yeah. So. And not hieroglyphics. Jeez Louise.
Hiragana?
No, the honorifics, that's it. They have honorifics going on too, with a lot of different, depending on the respect level or age level of the person that you're talking to, you have to vary your grammatical structures in addition to everything else.
Yes. Seriously. But she is so inspiring. I think she's been learning since high school.
Yeah.
And she, like, I look at her when I feel down and I'm like, it took Loretta a long time, but look where she is now. Like, you just have to stick with it.
Yeah.
So she is hashtag language goals.
Yes. Hashtag woot woot. I just had to do that. Okay. With all the languages that you've learned, now let's focus on Chinese. Let's focus on Chinese because that's such a unique creature. Because the European languages, you don't have the script switch. You don't have, like, a lot of the sounds are the same. Granted, there might be some that are different, but I mean, there's a lot of overlap. So let's focus on Chinese for a bit. How did you learn Chinese? What were your methods?
So I learned Chinese originally in college. That's where I got my foundation in Chinese. Yep. And shout out to my Laotians. They kicked my butt, but they really kicked my butt. They kicked all of our butts.
Yeah.
But so their method, I would say, was kind of old school. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it was a fully Chinese method, given, from my understanding, traditional Chinese education focuses so much on, you know, rote memorization.
Sure.
But for us, we would have quizzes every day or every other day. In our textbook, we would have to, oh God, like, I hated doing it back then, but now I understand why we did it. We would have to memorize the monologue or the dialogue.
Yeah.
And sometimes it would be like, Stephanie, recite the entire dialogue. We will stop you when we determine you should stop, and we'll have Taylor pick up the rest of the dialogue.
Oh my God. Incredibly,
it would be like, you're person one, I'm person two. We'd have to go back and forth. And, like, even though we would memorize it, you would always forget something.
Yeah.
But I really liked it because it did force you to speak in fluent sentences. Mm-hmm. And the biggest part for me was it helped to instill certain formulaic language and certain key collocations. So in retrospect, I like it. And moving forward, I want to do more of that in 2019. But not using textbooks, using comedy skits and TV show excerpts.
Oh, yeah. That's really cool. Okay, but we'll talk about that in a bit. But let's stay in the before time
for
a little bit longer.
But so in Chinese, so other things we did, we also, and I hated this part, we had to write out our characters on this grid paper, like between 40 and 60 times. It was awful. It was just so awful. I hated that. And then we would have tests at the end, although, like, this was such a blessing. But in our Chinese courses, they never made us take a final.
Oh, nice.
We would have, like, an end of the chapter exam at the end of the semester, but we never had a final. It was usually some final project. Periodically, like 3 or 4 times each semester, we would have our big oral exam where we'd have to put together some monologue using our vocabulary from those sections.
Nice.
So I think that's everything. Those are our major methods. Yeah.
Now, it sounds like that's a lot of work. So you probably didn't have time to use supplementary stuff outside of what they were assigning you, right?
No. Okay. And honestly, I hadn't even thought of it then.
Yeah.
I admit, I think the logical fallacy a lot of language learners make of, if I take this class, I'll be fluent. It's like, no way, homie. This is just scratching the surface. So it was a 5-credit course. We had 5 days of what they called ACT class, which is like a recitation where we would only speak in Chinese. Mm-hmm. And then 2 days a week, we had FACT class, which was in English, where we would go over grammatical concepts. So that was 7 classes of Chinese every week. So it was a lot.
That is a lot. So wait, did you use any flashcards, or, like, how did you learn the vocabulary?
From what I remember, it was just writing out the characters repeatedly over and over again. And then obviously for oral purposes, our oral tests and in class would help with it. Mm-hmm. But for just memorizing, I think I just wrote it out over and over again. At the time, I wasn't into language learning YouTube or Reddit.
Sure.
So like, my methods were, I would say, pretty basic. So it was just like, all right, I have to write this 1,000 times. Wow. And I remember writing things on the bus to go to school because I commuted. Mm-hmm. And like sometimes there'd be a Chinese person behind me and they'd be like, "You're learning Chinese?" And I'd be like, "Yes." And they'd get all excited, but they're like, "You did not write that in the correct order." That's a pet peeve of mine. I am a bad language learner because I don't follow stroke order, and it ticks Chinese people off a lot. I don't follow stroke order.
I want to believe that there might be some truth that it would look different enough if you're writing with a pencil or pen. But when Pleco dings me because I have it in the wrong order on a digital surface, I get angry because that's the same exact line with every stroke that I do with my finger. So that doesn't make sense to me. And then I have to do the undo button and do it in a different order and all that kind of stuff. And that doesn't make sense at all. So I want to sit down with the Pleco guys and go, first of all, thank you. Second of all, get rid of the stroke order.
But shout out to Pleco. It is overall a very good app.
Oh, it's incredible. Yes. And apparently, I haven't used it yet, but they have some new plugins with graded readers.
Oh.
That I'm pretty, it's a paid plugin, but I bought it, I started it and realized I still had like a few weeks to go before HSK3 test. And I was like, oh, I should probably focus on that. So I stopped until this very moment. I forgot about it. So now I have to remind myself to put that on my 2019 study. But yeah, it's super cheap and it's really good. And of course, because it's on Pleco, you as you're reading the graded readers, what you click on is the Pleco entry. With all of them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they've got a lot of cool stuff. Oh, and a Sherman Bao input too, so that you can go straight.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you can do Chairman Bao's stuff. Pleco now. So for those of you who aren't studying Chinese, Pleco is the Mandarin Chinese learning app of all apps. It has everything you could want, I suppose.
They have some pretty like unusual but authentic sounding sentences, so you can see words in context. And I believe they also have a plugin for classical Chinese if you're feeling ambitious as well.
Oh, no. No, I don't even look at the traditional most of the time. I'm like, I'm going to ignore that's sitting right there next to the simplified. And
no, not traditional Chinese characters.
No, I know. I know what you mean, but I don't even go to that level. And I feel like classical is like 20 levels above that.
I guess this is a good time to say I want to learn classical Chinese.
No!
I do. I actually took a class on it in college and didn't really touch it since then, but I want to take it back up. I like classical Chinese. It's terse, it's poetic, it's ambiguous, like it's a huge pain in the butt, but I like it. I really like classical Chinese.
Okay, for those of us at super low levels, what would you say is the biggest difference between, would we say modern Chinese and classical Chinese? Is that the dichotomy that we would?
Sure. So I would say the biggest, most apparent distinction is, so let's say you're an English language speaker or of any Western European language, and you're like, wow, Chinese is so concise. No, no, no. Like classical Chinese is what they can say in like 5 words would take, I swear, 15 to 20 in English. It is absurdly concise. Absurdly. Mm-hmm. And because of that, there is a lot of ambiguity. But at the same time, you have to remember back then, it was only the educated elite who were using it, talking about pretty limited topics. So at the end of the day, there couldn't have been that much ambiguity. But like, for example, in the Tao Te Ching, I'm a nerd. I've memorized part of the Tao Te Ching, but the opening lines are,
I
am.
All right. Everybody get your
coffee. The opening lines are, Dao ke dao, fei chang dao. My tones are not good. Ming ke ming, fei chang ming. And in English, that would be translated as, the way which can be spoken of is not the constant way. The way which can be named is not the name of the Tao, or something like that, which is very verbose, very Baroque, I would say. My translation wasn't perfect because I'm doing it offhand. My tones are bad. But classical Chinese is extremely, extremely concise, and it can be very confusing.
So classical Chinese is not the same thing as like a super formal.
No, Chinese. Although a lot of more formal Chinese still has elements of classical Chinese in it. But at the same time, I've rarely ever dealt with absurdly formal modern Chinese. So
I know some poems are part of classical Chinese, but is classical Chinese only poems?
No, I mean, it has a lot of your histories. Like if you've heard of Sima Qian, Records of the Grand Historian, that was written.
Yes.
So some histories. I'm not quite sure of there being like novels in classical Chinese. I'm sure there are. Mm-hmm. But from what I've heard,
they'd be really short.
I've heard of it. From my knowledge, classical Chinese was mostly poetry and histories. I could be wrong. I know I'm wrong.
Okay.
But that's, in fact, I think classical Chinese only refers to one period. I use it to mean like older Chinese, like let's say before the Tang for me. But yeah. I'm not sure that's the proper scholarly distinction.
I think that's generally how the term is used now in most circles that would talk about that. I mean, we're not talking about super scholarly Sino whatever scholars.
Mm-hmm.
We're just talking about the layperson. Yes. So wait, how did you... Okay, wait, we've got to make some connections here. So you went from studying Chinese in college for 3.5 years to the point where you're super fascinated with classical Chinese. At some point in your self-studying, you dove pretty damn deep. What did you do when you were doing those deep dives?
So, well, for classical Chinese, I took one classical Chinese class in college because you had to wait until you had 3 years of Chinese under your belt to do it anyway. My teacher then, extremely brilliant woman, but I feel like the class didn't go as deep as it could have. She was more of an old school professor who was like, I don't know, it wasn't quite the grammar translation method, but it was some pretty old school method. So I don't feel like I really learned that much classical Chinese then. No offense to her. Lao Shi, you are awesome. I don't think she's going to be listening, but like in the off chance she is.
You never know.
So I sort of like old languages. For me, they're kind of mysterious. That's why I like them.
Yeah.
And going back to the point of, you know, Chinese is such an integral part of my life. I really want to know more about it. Like your partner, like your romantic partner, you want to know everything about your romantic partner.
Yeah.
I want to learn everything I can about Chinese culture and history. And luckily, I have 5,000 years to dig through. But from a historical perspective, I'm really interested too in the Qin and Han periods. Mm-hmm. So that's another reason why I want to learn classical Chinese. Also, classical Chinese poetry. Let's just go back here. So my classical Chinese teacher also had a Chinese poetry class, and we read translations of Chinese poetry, but unfortunately there was no commentary to go with them.
What?
So there wasn't. It's this old book from like the 70s called Sunflower Splendor.
Okay.
And from what I remember, I could be wrong, but there was a lot of criticism for it because like it was multiple people doing the translations and they didn't have commentary to go with it. And my teacher who was, I think her thing was she was so brilliant, she had trouble speaking to people who didn't have her extreme depth of knowledge.
Uh-huh.
But I'm like, this poetry is very beautiful. I'd like to understand more about it. So that's also another reason why I want to learn so that I can read it in the original Chinese and then hopefully read the commentary in modern Chinese at some point. Yes.
Do you have room in your family for a third language? It sounds like you have a lot of time already sectioned off for Chinese.
I know. Honestly, I've honestly waffled back and forth about it. I can't imagine Chinese not being in my life.
Yeah.
At the same time,
what is it about it? Like, if you were to describe it as a person, what is it about it that is the pull?
This is strange because I've also described it as my language baby. So this is going to be like a weird mixing of analogies.
Go for it.
For Chinese, I mean, Chinese itself isn't a monolithic thing. It's been so heavily influenced by other cultures. Mm-hmm. So that in itself, it's like very diverse mix. I'm not quite sure. I would say that Chinese is one mysterious and it's just endless adventure and exploration, I would say. So you're never going to get tired of Chinese. Like I've wanted to learn Spanish and given the cultures of South America and Spain are very rich, but I would say there's still too much like that of other Western cultures.
Yeah.
Like at some point I would foresee myself getting bored. Whereas Chinese is just limitless adventure. And I mean, they played such a crucial role in world history. Like there's endless things to read about them.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that it's like endless exploration.
That's so true.
From a cultural and historical perspective. And then linguistically, I like how terse Chinese is. So Chinese is where I first learned about the concept of formulaic language.
Mm-hmm.
So our teachers would have us, because Chinese doesn't have conjugations, they would have us memorize patterns like shi, da 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 da, or yin wei, blah blah blah, zuoyi, blah blah blah. And I thought, oh, this is just unique to Chinese. How cool.
And then,
I know. Well, then I found out as I was doing some research, like, oh, all languages have formulaic language.
Mm-hmm.
But I just like how obvious it is in Chinese. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I like wordplay in Chinese. I love Chinese crosstalk. Like, on the one hand, as a non-native speaker, I am like, so much ambiguity. I'm missing the joke. But on the other hand, I'm like, so much ambiguity. I love it, you know? So I love the wordplay. I love how terse it is. I love how it's overall like a no-nonsense language. Mm-hmm. No offense to Arabic, very cool language, but too much nonsense going on there. Whereas in Chinese, you know, it's just like, here's the grammar. Start doing stuff with it.
I'm with Taylor. Let's forget about the nonsense and be very straightforward about this. I would love to have your feedback on this podcast. What do you like? What do you not like? What do you want to hear more of? Do you have any questions you'd like to submit to the podcast for me to ask future language learners of Mandarin Chinese? Do you have anybody that you'd like to suggest that I interview for the podcast? Do you have any questions about my own language learning that I can address over on the YouTube channel? That's only the beginning of the things that you can ask via social media or via email or even in the comment section on the Podbean app. Any way that you want to do it, my info, my username, my handle is Steph Fuccio, StephFuccio. Everywhere except Facebook, I went off Facebook again. So I'm still on Twitter, LinkedIn, Tumblr, Instagram, and anywhere else that exists. Please feel free to also email me, StephFuccio@gmail.com. I may talk about how crazy I am having 3 pod tubes, but let me tell you, I love receiving feedback. I look forward to hearing from you about your no-nonsense information about the Taming Script podcast. Thank you so much. Let's get back to Taylor.
I do have to say I'm having a time obsession that has lasted almost 2 years now. I'm almost to the point where I kind of understand how many different ways, or at least how many different ways there will be by the time I feel like I have a base of the language that they express time. And what I thought, this is my first tonal language that I've gotten anywhere with. Mm-hmm. And what I thought when people were talking about not having verb inflections, like walk, walked, walking, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. that was for the listeners, not for you, Taylor. What I thought would happen when people use time words is I thought they just use the same damn one. I thought they'd just be like what I used to do in baby Spanish when I used to say like the equivalent of I walked yesterday. Like I thought they'd do something like that, but there'd be like a yesterday, in the past, tomorrow, like the same word over and over and over. I was not ready for nouns, adjectives, verbs, pronouns, like every single part of speech being able to indicate the time, and you just got to be ready for wherever it is in the sentence whenever it hits. So my head's exploding a little bit, and I kind of want inflections back.
I don't mind the inflections, but I wish I'm a bad Chinese language learner.
Why?
But back in college, someone had said, like an older Chinese language learner, mm-hmm. you will never understand when and where to use le. You will just never understand.
I believe that.
Wish in Chinese, yeah. And it could be because I haven't gotten the consistent explanation yet, but I wish like the particles could have a little bit more rigid and defined use.
But then you have the ambiguity that you love.
I know.
Right?
I know. Yes.
See,
but the ambiguity is really only nice for like crosstalk and poetry, not in everyday life.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. No, I hear you. Well, I'm still trying to, I keep referring to the many hats of Zai because I just can't handle how many different things it does.
Oh yeah, it is.
I'm just not very good with languages, and I'm not very good with language. Like when I think I got something and then it does completely different, I'm like, oh wait, stop, rethink this. It's a multi, you're right, I should be looking at it as a person. Now that you've said that, I'm going to reframe it because I do get stuck on a word, especially when I think I understand it and I see it in a certain context a lot. When it switches and it's something else, I kind of freeze for a bit. And then I'm like, but I like multifaceted people. Why don't I like multifaceted words?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I would say that part of that too is just, again, no language learning resource is perfect. They omit a lot of key information. It's hard to be like, oh, zai means here. So it means, oh, ni zai ma, blah, blah, blah. And then they're like, oh no, it also means you're in the middle of doing something. So I understand the frustration. No, I almost wish that grammar books would be like, okay, this is zai. Here are like 30 pages about all the ways to use it. And then they would slowly introduce each one. So at least, though, you would know moving forward, okay, this isn't the only way to use it.
Well, myself. And those still do this. Those are reference books. But those you can't really learn from. Like, you have to learn language in layers somehow.
I know what you mean. I at least like to know, okay, it's going to get bumpy ahead. At least, like, know that. You know?
Yeah. And I do, to be fair, that's one of the things I don't like about Pleco is that when I go in and I save a word that's in the level I'm in, I want to be able to save the definition I'm currently working with, because seeing everything there is a bit overwhelming at first. And I want to be able to, like, color code or highlight, or at least just kind of go, I just want this one out of the 10 right now, and then I'll come back to the rest of you later, maybe.
Mm-hmm. So, I wish Pleco had some extension where you could see more sample sentences, because especially for those words where they have multiple meanings, like, can I know what collocations go with this, or like, what scenario is best to use this in? But that's what corpora are for.
That's true. Yeah, but do most people know where to find that?
I don't think most people would know to look for collocations. I didn't even know about them till I'd studied Chinese for like 3 years. I didn't know it was a thing.
Well, collocations and what's the other one? Because collocations and there's the noun equivalent to that, and I can't remember what the hell it is now. I learned a bunch of the terminology when I was teaching English overseas from British textbooks. So I learned a lot of the British English language of how to talk about grammar, and then went to a master's program in the US and had to learn not only the kind of layman's view, like grammatical terms, but then the academic language terms. And I was like, y'all need a glossary, like mapping all the words with each other, because this is driving me crazy. There's collocations, and then there's a second one with other groups of words that go together. And then there's just calling, like some folks just call them, wow. And this is what happens when you leave a freaking PhD, is all your brain just falls out with all the information that you thought you had. There's a word, there's a phrase that kind of lumps it all together under a big umbrella, so you don't have to dissect them out necessarily. You can just say phrases, basically phrases that the fixed language that you were talking about.
Okay. I don't know. For me, I always use collocations just as any word pairing, basically.
No? It is a word, and that is a phrase, and I understand your meaning, but that's not what it is. I'm going to send it to you later because it's a really cool term that does the umbrella thing that most people would recognize as those fixed phrases that I can't think of right now. I can even see the academic guy. I saw him at a conference when I can even see him. Oh, and you would love him. I should send you some of his academic articles, because he does a lot of the wordplay stuff. He actually started off his presentation doing some of the wordplay stuff that you were talking about a little while ago. And most of us are like, I have no idea why that's funny. But he was laughing up a storm, and we're like, okay. Let's leave college during your 3 years of self-study. What have you done? What methods have you used? What tools have you used?
So it's been very uneven because I've been busy since I left college. And in 2019, I hope to rectify that and get on a more steady schedule. So I think it's probably more instructive to talk about what I want to do than what I've done, because what I've done has just been inconsistent and I've been very mad at myself for it.
But
okay.
On some level, it's important that people know that it's not just a consistent linear trajectory that still moves the ball forward.
Okay. So,
and if you still don't want to, we can skip ahead. But
no. All right. So some of the stuff I've wanted to do, I've been trying to just do more content in Chinese. So Zhihu, Youku, although Youku is really hard to access in the States. Mm-hmm. Some Chinese.
Is it really?
Yeah, it is super duper slow.
Whoa.
And whenever I want to watch something, I have to watch a minimum of like 8 ads. So I hate using Youku. I try to find it on YouTube. Anyway, yeah, Youku is a real pain in the butt to use in the States.
For the listeners, Youku is the Chinese equivalent to YouTube, kind of.
A Netflix YouTube mashup. Sort of.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. Mm-hmm. Do you use Viki, V-I-K-I?
I've never heard of that.
Okay. Are you looking for small videos or like full TV shows and stuff?
A mix. Like there's this one, she's not a YouTuber. I guess she's a Youku-er, but her channel is called Amanda Eats, and it's just a cooking channel.
But she
has this really nice soft voice, and she always cooks unusual things that are super elaborate. So I like to watch her. And for Chinese TV shows, to be honest, I am a sucker for like super dramatic palace dramas, which are not useful for proficiency purposes. So, like, I love me a salacious palace drama.
Yeah.
you. But I saw there was a Chinese TV show that was touted as like the Chinese version of House of Cards, mm-hmm. which sounded interesting. But again, it was on Youku. It took forever to access and it's riddled with ads. And I just gave up after one episode. So I'm actually looking for TV shows to start watching.
Tom Reeds is his handle on YouTube and Instagram. And he's studying sinology in a master's degree in France. And he sent me this app called Viki. I'll try to spell it right now too for the listeners. It's V-I-K-I and then R-A-K-U-T-E-N. And they have Chinese, Japanese, Korean, like a bunch of Northeast Asian, Taiwanese, like a lot of those TV shows, movies, and those kinds of things. And it just, it has so many shows on here.
Okay.
And I haven't delved into it that much because I tried to listen to one TV show and realized, oh, I'm so not ready for that yet. I'm glad it exists. But yeah, I don't know if it'll have Amanda on it, but it will definitely have some TV shows.
Okay, I'll have to take a look into that.
What do you want to do with the language?
So for classical Chinese, I mostly just want to read poetry and like the old classics, like the Tao Te Ching, mm-hmm. maybe some Confucius, although I found the Analects kind of boring when I read it in college. That's Confucius's famous book of saying.
Right. Yeah, okay.
Oh, Stephanie, you're a bad Chinese language learner. You don't know about the Analects?
Don't ever shame people for what they focus on. No.
I'm teasing.
I never, ever claim to be interested in ancient history.
But that's sort of the famous book of Confucius' sayings that I believe his students put together, because I don't believe he wrote it. So for classical Chinese, it's mostly poetry I want to read, and then like some of your classic books, I don't ever want to read The Journey to the West in Classical Chinese. A dear friend bought it for me in Mandarin Chinese. I'm like, oh no, this is not going to happen. Not going to happen. Another person bought me this huge volume with tons of commentary in English. And I'm just like, ugh, no, I can't do this. So for what I want to do with Chinese, I do want to have pretty much a native like level of proficiency. Mm-hmm. I do want to use Chinese for business purposes. I'm looking for a job in marketing. So like 5 years from now, I would like to have Chinese that I could use for marketing, for job interviews, negotiations, mm-hmm. et cetera, and so forth. I want to be able to read Chinese novels and understand Chinese TV shows, blogs, whatever, with at least 80% comprehension rate. Mm-hmm. I want to raise my future children to speak Chinese. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to write short stories and flash fiction in Chinese. Mm-hmm. I know there's more stuff. I'll have it in the podcast. And I also, 2020, I want to pass the HSK6.
Yes. One of my coworkers just passed that, and I am absolutely in awe of him right now.
Yay. Good for him or her. Good for him.
Yeah, him. Yeah. Let's go back. Since I have issues with time, I'm going to go back and forth. Like, I'm not creating new ones. When you were first learning Chinese, I know you were, it sounds like you were pretty fascinated from the beginning, but what was the hardest part for you? Was there any part of learning it that was more difficult than other parts
of learning Chinese? Mm-hmm. Honestly, it was character retention. Mm-hmm. I remember the first few weeks into our level one class, we mm-hmm. were all like, we've learned 30 characters and we're already forgetting ones. Mm-hmm. And these are basic ones like tian or, you know, wo or things like that. So it's just character retention. Mm-hmm. And I think I read this somewhere, and I could be misinterpreting what I read, but I think they said for Chinese characters, Chinese people view it all as one unit, the character, the meaning, the pronunciation, whereas non-native speakers tend to view it as three independent entities that they have to tie together. Mm-hmm. So you're trying hard to remember three separate things, but use them in one way. And I would say that's pretty true. At least in my case, because I remember like a word, how to pronounce it and what it means, but I'll forget how to write it. And it's embarrassing, like some basic characters I forget. Or like I'll look at a character and I'll be like, oh, that's, you know, whatever. But I can't remember how to pronounce it for the life of me. Mm-hmm. So I would say it's remembering all those three aspects of a given word and being able to use it.
I get that. But I mean, they have so much more practice than we do, no matter when
they
start later on in
life.
They have years of hearing it before they even start saying it. And then they have years of doing that writing practice in school. And then they're constantly reading it. And yeah, so there's a serious head start. Having said that, what was the easiest part for you?
This will sound strange because I hate people who think a good accent means they speak a language well. But in college, I could do what I thought was a pretty convincing Chinese accent with inflection and all of that stuff. Now, after college, it's mostly been me studying alone. I've tried language partners. It just never caught on for me. So I don't have that many chances to speak. So my accent and fluidity isn't as great. Mm-hmm. But I thought actually speaking wasn't that hard.
Now, you've spent time in China. You were studying, let me see if I remember, you were studying in or near Beijing, is that right?
No, I've never studied in China. What happened was I won a competition mm-hmm. for a free trip to China.
Oh!
And I was in Beijing, Hangzhou, and Xi'an for 3 weeks.
Okay. How'd you win the competition?
It was a little language exchange app that I believe now is defunct.
Oh.
Yeah. But you had to write like a little essay and submit a short video about why you wanted to go to China and they would pay for you. And I wrote this essay and I made this video. I probably still have it. And that's how I won the trip to China. And it was all pretty fast because I applied in June. They mm-hmm. let me know at the end of June. And I was in China in early August of that mm-hmm. same year. So it was quite speedy and unexpected.
So how far into your language learning was that?
That was 3 years in. And that was actually kind of disappointing because it was only then that I realized our program focused on a lot of academic, more formal Chinese. Mm. And it was embarrassing when I went to the fruit vendor and I'm like, can I have a bunch of bananas? I'm like, I don't know how to say bunch as in bunch of bananas. And then I would get nervous and stutter. And I remember this jerk of a banana vendor in Xi'an said to his friend, oh, your English is better than her Chinese. Ha ha ha. And I was like, no, I'm just nervous, you know?
Yeah.
Mean old banana vendor in Xi'an. So yeah, that was 3 years in. Go ahead.
Yeah, and that was, okay, so that was Beijing, you said Beijing, Hangzhou, and what was the third place?
Xi'an.
Xi'an, okay. So in those third places, did you notice dialectical differences? Did any of that really stick out?
Yes. Oh, I really didn't like Hangzhou because people there had a very heavy Hangzhou accent. Mm-hmm. They do the thing where they mix up the different sounds, like for, I remember I was buying fruit again. I did more than buy fruit in China. I went to this fruit vendor and I got some stuff. And I remember he said, kuai. I'm like, okay, is that 40 kuai or 14 kuai? Mm. So I just gave him like 40 kuai and luckily that was the right thing. Mm-hmm. It was really hard to understand them. And I remember I asked like a street sweeper, I think for directions or where the nearest bus stop was. Mm-hmm. And he said something. I'm like, I have no idea what you're saying. And in all honesty, he wasn't speaking Mandarin. Maybe he was speaking whatever dialect is spoken in Hangzhou. But it was extremely hard for me to understand people in Hangzhou. And then in my hostel, I met some people from far southern China. I remember one was from Hainan. And I don't remember where the other ones were from. But I so struggled to understand them because I feel like the farther south you go, those more aggressive, harsh sounds of Mandarin Chinese disappear. So yeah, it was very difficult to understand the southerners. I think my favorite accent though was the Xi'an accent because that to me actually sounded what I thought a Beijing accent would sound like. It had mm-hmm. heavy rhoticization. It's mm-hmm. a little gruff, a little gritty and sandy. I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Rhoticization.
Rhoticization. Yeah.
That damn R. It's all over my textbooks, and honestly, people do not say it in Shanghai. Although, to be fair, there's so much Shanghaiese floating around that I still am having a hard time understanding entire sentences other than just a few individual words. Are you enjoying this episode with Taylor? I certainly am. There is a tiny rumor in my head, if that can exist, that we might expand to other languages with different scripts, different written scripts in 2020. But that's not this year, that's next year. This year, I want to gather as many folks as I can who are interested in language learning stories,
even if we are centered, quote-unquote, only just around Mandarin Chinese. How can we do that? Word of mouth seems to be the scientifically proven best way to share podcasts. I kid you not, look it up. So, could you please, 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 please send this podcast to just one person that you think might enjoy it? Or, if you can't think of one person, could you just please screenshot it and share it in any social media that you're in? Changing Scripts podcast can be found anywhere and everywhere that podcasts can exist. So all people need is just the title, Changing Scripts. So a quick screenshot and I love it, or I like it, or I think you'd enjoy this, would simply be the most wonderful thing you could do for this podcast. Thank you so much for spreading the word about the Changing Scripts podcast and us geeking out and talking about our language learning stories. Let's get back to Taylor. To someone who's not studying Chinese or not far along in the language, how would you, aka some of our listeners, how would you describe that Beijing R?
There's a couple of ways you could think of it. So at first I would describe it as sort of like pirate speech. Chinese speakers listening will get offended. I don't mean that in an offensive way. I love your language. I do. I would at first describe it as kind of piratey.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, it also kind of sounds like when a cat's purring. Like if you imagine a cat talking to you in a very languid way.
Well, not just sound wise, but like when it's used, when it's not used, where it's used. Well, I mean, why does it exist? Why isn't everybody using it in Mandarin?
I'm sure some of it is just borrowing from whatever their, you know, home dialect is. Maybe it's an influence from Mongolian-speaking people, since Beijing and Mongolia aren't that far. But I don't know if Mongolian has that rough R.
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting point. I hadn't actually thought about that. I just thought it was funny because it's like, okay, that's Beijing, but then there's this gigantic rest of the country and they're all learning, you know, standardized Mandarin Chinese, Putonghua, but they generally don't use the R, right?
I don't think so. Maybe it's a prestige thing. Like since Mandarin became standardized, you're not supposed to use the R. Because I don't think, from what I remember, I don't remember them ever telling us that the rhoticization was part of standard Chinese. That was just more northern Chinese, I thought.
Really? Oh, but Putonghua is...
Well, it was northern. Based on... It was heavily based on that, but I don't actually know.
Yeah, me neither.
That's a good question.
I mean, it completely doesn't matter when you're talking about just having communication, just communicating with people, but it's me giggle. I'm looking up Mongolian and I'm like, that's a really good theory. I want that to be true. Oh my gosh. Have you ever looked at the Mongolian language? That's beautiful.
It does have a pretty script. I actually, not sure if this is a myth, not sure, but I heard it's written that way so that Mongolian horsemen could write while on the neck of their horses while they're riding.
That makes sense because it is very right heavy.
Could be a myth.
That's really cool. I want that to be true. Some questions from previous guests. What language do you dream in? Because you have quite a bit of languages under your belt.
So I still dream in English, although there are times now where I just like want to respond in Chinese automatically, even though I'm conversing in English. And whenever I hear a foreign language that's not Chinese, I just want to start responding in Chinese. I still dream in English though, I would say.
Do you feel more emotional in English or in Chinese?
That's a good question.
It's not mine. It's Tanya's. Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you, Tanya. So I would say Persian is my emotional language. Oh. My Persian is nowhere near my Chinese or English. Persian is just like this sensuous, sexy language. It's very gorgeous. So if I was going to write something emotional or say something emotional, I would try to do it in Persian. Chinese to me is more of like a no-nonsense language. I would use it for business or just writing things down that are very matter-of-fact. So one of my goals is I want to start keeping a daily written and spoken diary in Chinese. Mm-hmm. But I've noticed that when I speak Chinese, I'm not very sentimental. Mm-hmm. I'm very just matter-of-fact. And I'm pretty matter-of-fact in English, but even more so in Chinese. So I don't foresee my Chinese diaries being very, very emotional, very sentimental. It's just like, this is what happened. It made me sad. This is what happened. It made me happy. Whereas in Persian, I'd be like, oh, this was the happiest day of my life or
so
whatever.
What is it about Persian that brings that side out?
It just has a gorgeous sound. It's mm-hmm. so lyrical. And Persian poetry has like a reputation of being mm-hmm. some of the best with Hafez. And oh, who's the other? Omar Khayyam. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's somebody I'm forgetting, but it just has a really gorgeous sound. And it's actually an Indo-European language. So it's not that grammatically mm-hmm. difficult. There are still some verb conjugations that I'm not really comfortable with. But I would say it's like Spanish is to me as well. Mm-hmm. It's not that different from English, but it has a certain je ne sais quoi.
It does.
That just makes it much prettier.
And let's be honest, Persian men, not too ugly.
Persians overall are like incredibly good looking.
My goodness. I had a bunch of Iranian students when we taught in Kuala Lumpur, and I was not fully prepared for them to look like my Italian cousins. I've never traveled to Iran. I never really ran into a lot of Iranians anywhere in the world. And suddenly there's a bunch of them in my classroom, and I'm like, this is awesome. I don't need to go, you know, extra
visa. In Kuala Lumpur? Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because the visa restrictions were a lot easier. Malaysia keeps changing language of education. Sometimes it'll be Bahasa Malay, and sometimes it'll be English. And at the time, a lot of the colleges' medium of instruction was English. So a lot of them were coming in and from Iran, from Kazakhstan, from a lot of Gulf Muslim countries. They were coming in. I had a lot of Yemeni students, Saudi Arabian students,
Really?
Because they could get into those schools because of the Muslim connection that they couldn't get into in the US or the UK or Australia or stuff because it was much more difficult. I just had all of these students from these places that I've never been to that would be really difficult visa-wise for me to go to, let alone work in. And I was like, yeah, this is so cool. And here sat these Persian students who look like my Italian cousins. And I'm like, including the gold chains and the shirt buckle, you know, all the way down and the curly hair and just the attitude was like, hey, you know, they're just boisterous and stuff. And I'm like, what? Wait, what? This is not the view I had from you from the newspaper.
Yes. Yeah. Persians are cool. I'd love to go to Iran at some point to visit.
Yeah. Other than the pollution thing, which is ironic that I'm sitting in Shanghai saying that, it sounds absolutely amazing.
Mm-hmm.
The mountains all around it and the food, and because of course they brought in food during like all of our, you know, end of class days and stuff, like everybody yes. bringing food from their home country, and I'm like, I'm in freaking heaven right now.
Oh yes, I took one Persian class in college, and our teacher, I'll just call her Hanum, which means, you know, madam, she was older, but she was always dressed to the nines and like the nicest clothes, the nicest makeup. But one time she brought in just pita bread with cherry jam and feta, which apparently is a common breakfast in Iran. And I was like, Hanum, I love you. This is delicious. I love Persian cooking. Overall, it's not that complicated. Emphasizes a lot of fresh ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. I try to cook a lot of Persian food when I can.
And because there were so many Iranian students in the schools that we were teaching in, there were a lot of restaurants that popped up around the schools to feed them. And there was this one small restaurant, and he had the most amazing food. And he had, it's not tagine like the tagine that everybody has in Middle Eastern restaurant, but and I even forget how to spell the name of the dish, but it sounds like tagine, but it's not the one that everybody knows about. But it's this baked rice dish, and it has, I think it was cranberry. It's been a long time now, but I think it was cranberries. There's definitely meat, the rice, and all of these delicate spices, and it's baked, and it was just the most succulent, most beautiful thing ever. And I'm not even a rice person, and I was so addicted to this thing. And I haven't been able to find it in a restaurant since, and now I've forgotten how to spell it, so I wouldn't even make it. But it was the most amazing thing.
If you're feeling ambitious, I know Chinese kitchens tend to be small, but if you can find all the ingredients, there's a good Persian cooking recipe website called Nusheijan.
Mm.
I'll send you the link later,
awesome.
But she has like some really good Persian recipes. And then she'll do, like I would say, things that are more American, like ice cream. But just the way she does it feels so like wholesome and like something my grandma would do.
Yeah.
I
and love the pistachios. They put pistachios in all
they
that.
They do love their pistachios.
Oh my God. It's just the combination of things. You're right. It's very simple, but it's really flavorful.
They do have this candy. Okay. Last thing about Persian cooking.
Yeah.
They have this candy called Gaz, G-A-Z, which is a nougat with pistachio.
Yes.
Oh, it's so good.
It's really, really good. Well, no, let's talk about food in China. Was there any favorite that you had while you were here for those 3 weeks?
Well, you see, I'm a vegetarian, so limited on what I could eat. I told people, I had learned, you know, 我吃素 means I am a vegetarian. Mm. And when I came back, people are like, no, you should say 我吃斋, which means, I'm not sure if that's the right tone, which means I eat vegetarian for religious reasons, like mm-hmm. if you're a Buddhist or something. Mm-hmm. But when I told people, they would be like, huh? And then I had multiple strategies. I'd be like, I am allergic to pork and I don't like beef and I don't like chicken mm-hmm. that much. And like, they would just look at me like, who is this crazy mm-hmm. white girl? Just anyway, so some food I did like was Sichuan spicy green beans. Those mm-hmm. are my jam. They are delicious. I love my Sichuan spicy green beans. Mm-hmm. I had some dumplings that were okay. I don't know. It was weird for me in China because my first 2 days I ate like nothing because I was just like jet lagged. In the mornings, I usually ate just fruit because I didn't want to have a breakfast. Yeah, I would say the Sichuan spicy green beans were my absolute favorite.
Nice.
And then, oh no, I forgot the other one. In Xi'an, I found this like literal hole in the wall restaurant that must have been like 10 feet long. But they had the best spicy noodle dishes. It was just noodles with like red peppers and scallions. Mm-hmm. I saw the lady, she had like a mini fridge. She pulled out this giant plastic bowl of dough, mm-hmm. hand rolled them herself. They were done in like 5 minutes. Those were my two favorite dishes. Oh, I would go back for those noodles. And they were only like 7 kuai.
Yeah.
It was absurdly cheap.
Okay, next question's from Vaughn. Vaughn's question is, with all of the technology being developed for with languages, if they developed one where, you know, kind of the chip in the head kind of thing, mm-hmm. where you didn't have to learn, would you still want to go through the process of learning languages without that technology?
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I would totally eschew the chip. Because communication is personal.
Mm-hmm.
You have, this is another one of my language rants, but I hate getting technology involved in language learning as mm-hmm. a translator. Mm-hmm. There's too much nuance to go around in everyday communication about mm-hmm. your status, your relationship, your intended meaning, mm-hmm. your superficial meaning, historical background, shared experiences.
Mm-hmm.
A computer or a chip, whatever, would just totally stink at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like communication is something too personal to rely on a chip to do it for you. Now, if it was something obviously transactional, like you're buying something at the store in China and you don't speak Chinese, whatever, like ask how much it is or do you have this in a size medium? Sure. But if you're doing anything beyond that, which is so transactional and ephemeral,
mm-hmm.
I'd say don't get your chip involved.
Don't get your chip. That needs to be a t-shirt. Take your chip out of my head. I struggle with that question because I struggle with languages. My answer was more like, if it was more like a dictionary where I could turn it on and off and choose what came out of my mouth mm-hmm. and I could just get information without having to look at anything physically, then I'd be like, I want part of it, but I don't want it to do the speaking for me. I want to do the thinking and the talking and the selection of the words and phrases. I want to do that no matter how badly they might come out of my mouth. I want to have that ultimate final control over everything. But then having something creepy like that in my head would also be very strange.
Yeah. I don't know how useful it would be. It would only be useful to people who are speaking dominant language as it is, because I don't know that they could ever get a chip that was knowledgeable enough about a lesser known language. Like, I don't know, let's say Xhosa, and I'm pretty sure I'm mispronouncing that, which again, has a sizable amount of speakers, but not mm-hmm. nearly as many as English or Arabic or Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I feel like it would give uneven translations to mm-hmm. people who are native speakers of a less widely spoken language. Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure, sure, sure. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. There's a lot of flaws that it would definitely have. I don't know. I feel like there probably is a lot more effort that could be put into the personalization and excitement and way that we teach languages
mm-hmm.
more so than the technology to shove something in our heads, probably.
Yes, we really need to change how we teach languages.
Yeah.
You're hitting all of my hot buttons today.
Well, that's the reason why we click so much, is because we agree on a lot of stuff.
Yes. Yes.
Oh no, so I'm perpetuating the whole like silo thing. I'm interviewing someone that I agree with so we can perpetuate the ideas that we both agree with. Ah, phooey, who cares? Final question. Keep in mind for this question that we interview both people who have learned or are learning Mandarin Chinese as well as people that grew up with the language. So for either group, any of those groups of folks, what questions are missing? What would you like to know about those people's processes, experiences, or anything?
I would like to know from other learners of Chinese how and when they make the transition from graded reader content to authentic content, and what do they use? Because it's so hard to find authentic content that is written at a reasonable level that doesn't pull in a ton of antiquated phrases or just advanced long tail vocab that you're not going to see again.
And what's your answer to that? How did you do it?
I still use some graded readers just for like, I'm studying for the HSK, so this helps beef up core vocabulary. For me, I've decided you have to start with short form content. I got these two anthologies of flash fiction, which if your readers don't know, flash fiction is a super short story. The definition will vary, but usually it can be a short story that's only 100 words or a short story that's less than 1,000 words. But it's typically shorter than a short story. So that's still a lot of new vocabulary in each piece, but it's a more manageable piece to work through. And something that I've been looking at a little bit this year, and I want to do more in the next year, is go to Zhihu. I'm not sure if your readers know what Zhihu is.
Have you heard of it? I know what it is. What is that?
Or have you heard of Quora before?
Yeah.
Okay. So Zhihu is basically Chinese language Quora.
It's a
question and answer forum. And the questions there are variable length, but they're still shorter than your average news article. And there's more chance for personalization. Because whereas a news article is just what the reporter chose to write about, Zhihu is, you know, questions or problems that real people have. And there's probably overlap with your own interests. So in that regard, it's shorter content that's authentic, but also more applicable to your daily life. So I would start off with Zhihu. And I forget where they are. My teacher sent them to me a while ago. I lost them. But there are some websites where you can read fiction that people just publish online in Chinese as well, like short stories and stuff. And the Chairman's Bow is a good resource, but that's a graded reader online. But it's still good. Yes.
Zhihu, is that Zhihu? Is that the right one?
Yeah, Zhihu.
Hu. Okay. Yeah, I don't. I'm always iffy with literature because there's so much. It's like TV shows, literature. There's so much. Like for TV shows, there's so much casual language. There's so much slang. There's so much like. All that kind of stuff is really challenging for many levels of a language learner. And then when you get to literature, I mean, it's a creative endeavor. So there's stuff that even a native speaker wouldn't know because the writer just made it up.
Other thing too, now this would be for someone who's in intermediate to high intermediate. You have to be confident in your Chinese, but you could also try a Chinese author named Yu Hua. He's very prolific, very renowned. But he has a very famous short novel called To Live, Huozhe. And I have it in Chinese. I haven't completed it. But Yu Hua writes in a pretty straightforward style. I would say he's like what Steinbeck is to us. You know, he writes about everyday people and everyday style. He's funny, but I would say it's overall humor that you could get if you weren't Chinese. It's like more universal humor.
Yeah.
So try Yu Hua, some of his
stuff. Recommended him to me before, haven't you? Because that sounds really...
Yes, I have.
Okay.
His book, Brothers, was the first Chinese novel I ever read. I read it in English. Yeah. But it's a great novel. And like that now is like the goalpost I hold other Chinese literature to. Wow. And nothing's come close. It was just, it's about two Chinese people in the context of modern Chinese history. But I would say a lot of the messages and themes are universal. Right. It's very touching. Yes.
Oh, see, I'm reading a lot of stuff in the English translation about Shanghai and China. And I look forward to reading in Chinese, but honestly, I don't know how many years in the future that is. That feels like a long way to go. I don't know if I'll ever get over spacing. I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if that's ever going to happen easily. I don't know if I'll ever read for pleasure because it feels stressful to want to insert spaces between words all the time.
See, that has never bothered me at all. And it should have.
No, no, it's good that it hasn't. Because let me tell you, it's not fun. It's so not. I mean, that's a basic thing. And it's just perpetuating. I mean, it's nice because now I can figure out the word I don't know, even if I don't necessarily know the rest of the words that either look familiar or or generally speaking, I mean, there's a ton of two character words. So it's like, okay, these two are probably together. This is together. I definitely know this and this and this means this. So this is probably the word I don't know. I'll draw it in Pleco and boom, there it is. But, that's a lot of effort.
Well, you know, now that you bring that up, that's happened to me too. It'll be like, maybe let's say a three character word. And I know the first two characters, but I'm like, this third one doesn't make sense. What the heck do they mean? And then you find out it's some suffix or it's a different compound word. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, that makes more sense now. Mm-hmm. I do like how Chinese make compound words, but the same time, I wish they had some sort of suffix they could say to indicate this is a compound word as opposed to just, you know, that can be a little tedious.
Well, that exists. It's called spaces. it doesn't need to be an agglomerative language. They don't need to put anything on. They just need spaces. And yeah, it can be playful and it can be fun, but it's a bit much right now. I don't know. It'll be curious. Like 4 or 5 years from now, I'll be very, very curious if I ever get over this or if this is just something that keeps gnawing at me the whole time. Mm-hmm.
Someone else you might want to try out. Her name is San Mao. She's deceased, but she wrote a lot of like travelogues and memoirs about her travels. Mm. I have one of her books. Only read part of it, but I do have a friend who finished it in Chinese and she said her writing style is just very straightforward.
Yeah.
Not a lot of, you know, flowery language.
Yeah.
So that might be something worth checking out too. And plus it's interesting because it's a travelogue. So she's got, you know, a juicy story to tell you.
That's very, very, very cool. Yeah.
Sort of unrelated, but for anyone learning Chinese, don't read Mo Yan until you've been like learning Chinese for 20 years. Because I try to read his stuff in English and there's just so much historical and social political context. It's like, I don't get what you're going at, Mo Yan, you know. And he's also very prolific, but avoid him unless you're very confident in your Chinese skills.
Did a lot of people tell you to read his stuff?
No, I've been trying to read more Chinese literature. And there's only so much available in English translation, but I thought he's, you know, prolific and he's won a Nobel Prize. So I thought he must be writing something good. Mm-hmm. You have to have a much deeper understanding of Chinese history and culture to get it. And I'm just not there yet. Plus he likes a lot of wordplay and entendres and stuff. And it's just like hard to follow.
Honestly, my week has been made because as you're saying these, I'm typing them in Pinyin and finding the people. And I consider that a triumph. I could not have done that a year ago. Yay. I can recognize sounds. Damn it. It's progress, even if it's still really low.
No problem.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. This has been really, really interesting. And when you decide on which language you're going to include or invite into the family next year, please let us know. I'd like to let the listeners know where you landed on that.
I would love your readers' input whenever you publish this, because I was thinking January 1st is when I'm going to start it, but I'm like, I have too much going on with Chinese and Persian. Like this has to wait until the spring.
Yeah.
Question for you, Stephanie.
Yeah.
Which one would you recommend out of that mix?
It's such a personal decision. It depends on like the questions you need to ask are, what do you want to do in the language? Mm-hmm. Like, do you want to read something specific? Do you want to listen to or watch something specific? Do you want to talk to someone or a group of folks about any particular topics? But I mean, like a super refined goal. And for me, do you want to go there? Do you want to live there? Like, I kind of think of those questions too. Like, what's the uses of the language?
So I guess for my third one, I'd like to use it for business in general, like in my job in the future. So conferences, interviews, stuff like that. I also want it to be one that I could read a lot of literature in. I'm not a TV or movie person really, but I do love reading. So something that also has like a very sizable body of literature that's accessible. That's the problem I've had with Arabic. Arabic is so difficult.
Yeah.
Like the literature is inaccessible for like 20 years for me.
It sounds like an Indian language. You were saying Tamil, and what was the other Indian language you were debating?
Tamil or Hindi?
Hindi, yeah. It sounds like one of those might be more of a reader's paradise. But I'm not super familiar with the scripts or anything else. But I mean, the thing I'm trying to get at is the motivation, not just how useful is it, but how much do you want to dive into that language? How attracted are you? If we're going to go with the people analogy, which I really, really
I want them all, though.
No, but you have to pick. Awesome. Although in some cultures you can marry multiple people, let's pretend like you can only have three in this particular language culture.
Yes. Well, I was really gunning for Swahili for a while because it sounds like, to me, just a very happy-go-lucky language. Mm-hmm. And the grammar is not too silly, you know? No, again, no offense to Arabic, but that's a bunch of nonsense. I was just like, you know, I'm not that interested in the culture of Africa, and especially Swahili-speaking regions at this point in my life. I'm sure it's fascinating and very rich, but I mean, I've always had an interest in Asia and then a secondary interest in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So it's tough.
So maybe make a list of certain pieces of literature that you want to do and see where they fall more in and study that language. Mm-hmm. It's hard.
It is very hard.
Yeah. It's a good problem to have, though.
What are your language learning goals for 2019?
I'm still forming them.
Okay.
I did pass, although not a super high, to a super high level, HSK3. But again, that's reading, writing, and listening, which is perfect because in some ways, because my goal has always been reading. I will eventually speak more than a word here and there, but I truly, truly don't care how far, how fast or how long it takes to get that down. But I've been debating on whether to do HSK4 or not, and not doing structured chapters for 2 weeks. I feel kind of bored with what I'm trying to do. The resources I thought I would use aren't as good, and I never thought I'd say this, as the HSK text that I'm using.
Okay.
So I'm going to start digging into HSK4 very slowly, the opposite of what I did this year. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to review, right now I'm reviewing HSK 1 and 2 in December because they're a lot lower and I can go through them pretty fast and pick up on things that I wasn't either ready for or didn't see or don't remember from those levels. So I'm doing that in December. Starting January, I'm going to review HSK 3 one chapter a week and HSK 4 one chapter a month until feel like I'm more comfortable with 3, because there was, I don't know how much you've looked at what's in each of the HSK levels, but 3 just kind of exploded. 1 was pretty easy, 2 was okay, you're still going, and 3 just kind of like, wah. Yeah. So
I think, doesn't HSK 4 have 1200 new words too? So
no, it's doubling. So like I have 600 already. So then it's adding another 6. So what they give you
okay.
is total in the level. So it includes the 6 from before.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's still a lot to work through though.
Oh, it is, which is why I'm going to go slow until I feel bored and then challenge myself more with it. And we'll see what's happening. But I did HSK 3 one chapter a week, and that was crazy. So I'm surprised I passed it all. Like, that's just, yeah, that was nuts. And it was the first time I did the computer test for 3. I did the paper for 1 and 2, and I did the computer for 3. And I hate how they formatted the computer test. It was completely illogical and counterproductive to a human being.
Yeah, I saw your video about that.
Yeah, it was really bad. So I will, despite the fact that my writing will be crap and I'll get dinged for that, I will take the paper test the next time. For when I do.
Okay.
Yeah. Because it's just such an awful, awful setup with the computers. And it's not just here. That is the setup for the test anywhere. It's the same test everywhere. So
I'm not sure if you'd be interested, but on Coursera, they do have HSK courses.
Mm-hmm. I saw that. And they're a little expensive from what I remember. And the course books I'm using actually come with everything. It's got audio. It has exercises. It has a workbook. It has the vocabulary. It's got everything. What I want to do this time, though, is in addition to using those books and doing all the reviewing, is I'm also going to add back in writing, because I like drawing the characters, and I say drawing intentionally. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to add writing back in, and I want to add a tutor back in and do a little more back and forth with the stuff I'm struggling with, not just kind of go, I'll come back to that later. Like, I want to focus on it now. And that's why I only want to do like a chapter a month in the new stuff, because I actually want to take it slower, go a bit deeper, try to add tiny bit more of the speaking component to it.
Okay. Makes sense.
So yeah, that's four. But I still need a lot more vocabulary. 600 words is crap. I still can't read most of the stuff I encounter. So a lot more vocabulary, and just keep going with the other stuff.
Okay.
Let's see what happens. So thank you so much, Taylor, for coming on Changing Scripts today. This has been fantastic.
Thank you for inviting me.
What is going to be the name of the podcast, by the way?
So the tentative name is Becoming Multilingual. I don't really like it. Nice. It's not that creative, but it's my placeholder name until I get something a little more jazzy.
Gotcha.
So Becoming Multilingual.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, yay. And definitely keep us posted on what happens with you. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Changing Scripts podcast. Remember, there is a YouTube video that came out today as well. If your podcast app is awful and doesn't show you the show notes or they're not clickable, you can find all of the information in this podcast as well as the YouTube link at changingscripts.podbean.com. I also mentioned before that I have three different podcast and YouTube channel combinations called PodTubes because I am a crazy person. And those can be found at Steph Puccio, stephucio.weebly.com. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Changing Scripts podcast. I look forward to more language stories in the future. More soon. Sachi.